back. WNST, Towson, Baltimore. And Baltimore Positive. We're positively at the John W. Fadley Seafood Raw Bar. Oysters, clams, beer, and crab cakes since 1782. The old Lexington Market. About to move into the new Lexington Market. It's all brought to you by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. We'll be giving these away. Bill Cole has left the building. Damian Hahn's going to be back a little later on talking about the market, the future of the market. Our friends at Window Nation are still with us. The floppy hat is here, 866-90-NATION. You buy two, you get two free. You get 2 years, 0% financing. In preparing myself for 4th of July weekend, we had a very famous segment we filmed here. 3 million people clicked on Damie's hands showing me how to properly open a crab. And I figured 4th of July weekend, I want to focus on the bay, talk about water a little bit, and fishing and preparing fish and eating fish, as well as the market. Mardi Gary is something that involves the Potomac and fisheries and commissioning. What do you do other than be related to the Moeller family, live in Catonsville, and tell Damie how much you're going to be eating her crab cakes up the street?
Well, thanks for having me on, Nestor. So I am a fisheries biologist by academic training. I've worked for almost 30 years for the Maryland Department of Natural Resources in Annapolis in their fisheries service as a fisheries scientist and manager. Worked with crabs, oysters, fish of all different types in the Chesapeake Bay and the Atlantic Ocean primarily during that time. About 10 years ago, I went to take a job at a little agency that not many people are aware of, but it's been around since 1963. It's called the Potomac River Fisheries Commission. That little agency is located in Colonial Beach, Virginia. So you go down southern Maryland through La Plata, cross the Nice Bridge, which has been rebuilt. You go over into Virginia near Dahlgren, and you go about 10 miles south. That's where Colonial Beach is. That's where my office is. And the agency is pretty interesting because it was created in 1963. Over a fatality over oysters. Oysters were being poached on the Potomac River back in the 40s and the 50s, and some Virginia poachers were out on the river. A young Maryland natural resource police officer at that time, that was called the Oyster Navy back in those days, came up on this group to apprehend them in the process of poaching oysters. And that group made a run for it, and a young officer shot and fatally killed a 26-year-old waterman from Virginia. It made the headlines the next day, and the two governors got together and said, well, nobody's going to kill anybody over oysters anymore. So they got together and created this little commission that I now run. And John F. Kennedy signed the enabling legislation in 1962, and we held our first meeting in January of 1963. I'm only the third person to run that agency since 1963.
Well, it's amazing to me, I guess, waters that run between states or between countries, especially countries that might or might not get along, or states where governors are fighting over this or that. I mean, the Chesapeake and the tributaries and sharing water, that somebody dumps something in Pennsylvania and it shoots down into Maryland, right? Like, and the water's so sacred, right? I don't need to tell you that, having been out there, from a food source, from factories polluting, from my old man working down at the point, and I have the Trade Point Atlantic people on all the time, just how sacred the water is and that it needs to be managed.
Yeah, and so this agency runs, so we manage the fishery resources. Maryland, it's important to know, Maryland owns the river to the Virginia mean low water mark, so the Virginia shoreline. But they formed this agency over this conflict on oysters so it could be co-managed because, as you would guess, people leave from Virginia, they're Virginia residents, Virginia watermen, Virginia fishermen, crabbers, etc. They go out, both sides use the river. So Maryland and Virginia governors got together, formed this agency to co-manage the fishery resources. So our jurisdiction starts at the Woodrow Wilson Bridge and goes down to where the Potomac meets the Chesapeake Bay. It's about 100 miles of river. So we have crabs, oysters, all kinds of fish, shad, striped bass.
Trout?
Sea trout.
Sea trout, okay.
not further up the Potomac. It's a great trout river, as you know. You talked about Dan Rodericks and floating out on the north branch of the
Potomac. And that's really West Virginia up there, too.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Up there, it borders West Virginia. But, yeah, so I've been managing this agency now for about the last 10 years after leaving DNR. And we're part of the interstate group called the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. So those are the states from Maine to Florida that manage all the migratory species, like shad and striped bass, also known as rockfish locally. and a whole host of other species. So I've been down there, and it's, again, it's a little agency, not too many people know about it, but I spent almost 30 years with DNR, so I know a lot of the watermen and a lot of the fishermen around the Chesapeake Bay.
So I'm the village idiot from Dundalk that's, you know, threw a chicken neck out on Bear Creek. I've thrown a fly into the water. I mean, I'm not out on the water. I eat fish. I talk about fish. Obviously, the crabbing industry is something the last couple of years with H-2B visas and, you know, pickeries and going out of business and crab meat going to $60 a pound and all of that. What does my audience need to understand, not about your job, but about the water and how it affects the economy and how it affects you, your ability to eat local fish? And there's so many snakeheads in the news, right? I mean, Damie talked about the catfish, and I know Wes Morris talked about that. I'm going to talk to him about it when I get him on next month. What do people need to know about what's going on the water?
I think the simplest answer to that question, Nestor, is it all comes down to two things: water quality, how clean the water is, and habitat. We have millions and millions of people that have moved to this watershed because they want to live near the Chesapeake Bay. They want to recreate on the Chesapeake Bay, and they want to eat the seafood resources from the Chesapeake Bay. And if we don't have good, clean water and we don't have good habitat for those aquatic species like crabs and all the other oysters and fish that we have, it doesn't matter. So my job is to manage the fishery resources. We want to make sure that not too many oysters or crabs are being harvested. We set limits. We're the bad guys often to set parameters on when and how much resources like crabs and oysters and fish can be caught. But we can't do that if we don't have clean water and we don't have good habitat. So it's really important to work collaboratively with all the scientific community, the politicians, and the public to make sure that we maintain good, clean water and good habitat. And everybody wants that, right? Everybody wants to visit the Chesapeake Bay. If you get a chance to go out once a year, or you can go out, you're lucky enough to go out every day and you live down near the water, you want a good, clean Chesapeake Bay and all the tributaries that flow into it.
I'm glad I live long enough to do the tour. I mean, I mean that sincerely. And you've been helpful. So many people have just been kind to me, reached out. But over the last two summers of doing the 30-30 in August specifically and driving around and how many bridges we went over, people we saw with boats, gear, fishing, black people, white people, old people, young people, Asian people, local people, tourists, all, I mean, boats from the marlin down in Ocean City and seeing what that industry looks like and those people to, like, literally just seeing the most humble old couple sitting with a cooler with floppy hats on, kind of like my Window Nation hat, just trying to catch fish, you know, and it's a part of life that passed me by. Probably watching too much baseball, too much football, too much hockey. You know, you get pigeonholed into doing things, but the outdoor life, that part of it, has been really enticing to my wife and I. My wife's become a birder, and she's way more into hiking and doing all that things, and even into bees, her dad. But the water part of the Chesapeake Bay, I have a friend of mine that I know who moved to Kansas many, many years ago. And she brought her teenage kids back this week. They've never been to Maryland. So I'm thinking, like, kids from Kansas get a map, and they see all this water, and they see the ocean, and mom's telling them about there's life beyond pizza and chicken fingers in Maryland. You can have seafood and crab cakes and oysters and all of these things. And I think to myself how blessed we were to be here, to grow up here, but understanding and respecting. I never really knew anybody that worked on the water. Like, all my people worked at the point and stuff like that. My community wasn't taking boats out and bringing fish back or bringing crabs back. But when you go onto the Eastern Shore, you see it's a way of life. Like, literally, for it's how people feed. That's where this stuff comes from, right? And Mr. Bill always says here, he said, crabs, one thing in the world that, you know, you can't breed it. You have to go out and catch it in the wild. Marty Gary's here. Tell me your assignment and your position again, because I want to get your title right.
Yeah, so, Nestor, my name is Marty Gary. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Potomac River Fisheries Commission. So that's a fancy title for I'm the lead guy at the Potomac River Fisheries Commission. We're a small group. There's only five of us, and we manage the fishery resources, oysters, crabs, and fish in the Potomac River from the Woodrow Wilson Bridge to where it meets the Potomac, the Chesapeake Bay, about 100 miles of river. And we're participatory with Maryland, Virginia, and management of the resources that are shared in the Chesapeake Bay under the Chesapeake Bay program. So think crabs. The Potomac, Maryland, Virginia can't do it on their own. They all work together to do a winter crab survey, which then develops.
I want to ask you about that, because are you the guys that tell me there's one crab per 100,000 this, and this is going to be a good year or a bad year? And how in the world do we predict this, right? But, I mean, you can measure the eggs or the tell me about this.
Yeah, so for the crab survey, which has been really it's been in the news a lot the last couple of years because the numbers haven't been as good as we've liked. A lot of attention's been paid to it, but in short, what happens is every year since 1990 during the winter, so December, January, February, there's a survey done in Maryland and Virginia and in the Potomac River where my jurisdiction is. The Virginia survey is conducted by Virginia Institute of Marine Sciences. The Maryland survey is done by the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. They go to 1,500 sites throughout the Chesapeake Bay. These sites are randomly selected. They put a dredge overboard. The idea is crabs are basically dormant. They're not moving around. So you can sample them. They're in one place, right? It's cold. They're hunkered down. You can go in and sample and get an estimate and extrapolate that sample to determine the
1,500 is a lot. That's a
right.
That's a real. You're a scientist. That's a sample size. That's not. We're going to go drop something in back river and see what we find. Right. Literally.
Yeah. So this was the 33rd survey that was initiated in 1990, and out of those 33 years, that survey has been an accurate predictor of abundance for the following crabbing season. In other words, you get a survey, it shows X number of males, X number of females, X number of little baby crabs, the juveniles we call them, and that enables us to predict what the abundance is going to be in the next crabbing season, which has started. So the crabbing survey from this past year did show some positive news. Female abundance was up, every metric was up, but it came up from last year really, really low numbers. So we were very concerned last year. We're still concerned, but those numbers came up. But it looks like what the survey can tell us with probably 95% accuracy is, are we going to have a good year or are we not going to have such a good year? And it helps us frame what we can allow to be harvested without over-harvesting. So, for instance, this year, in response to those increased numbers of crabs we saw in this year's winter survey, at those 1,500 sites I was telling you about, we loosened up our crab bushel limits a little bit. The crabbers are restricted in Maryland, Virginia, and the Potomac as to how many bushels of crabs they can take per day. In the last couple of years, prior to this year, we've cut them back because we've seen declining numbers in the survey. This year, the numbers ticked up. We loosened those up a little bit. So it's a mechanism that allows us with high confidence to set limits for
keep the bay healthy.
Yeah, to manage a sustainable crab resource.
Martin O'Malley sat in this space, about 4 years before the plague, so it was quite some time ago. And when I asked him what he's most proud of, because he had a book about, managing policy, basically, managing the government. And it was an interesting book and very, had a lot of graphs and different measurements. But when I asked him, he said the thing he's the most proud of is the bay. And his work with the Bay and how just important it is. And it's hard to make it a sexy topic, right? It's only a sexy topic when crab meat's $60 a pound. Or when Damie came to me a couple months ago and talked to me about catfish. So this is something that I have not talked about last year or the year before. I don't know if it's new or not. Snakeheads were all the rage for a while. $60 a pound. We had COVID. We've had, all sorts of issues. What's the catfish thing? And I grew up in Dundalk. Drove across the Back River Bridge. All I ever saw were catfish coming out of that water. Now, I don't know why. I mean, the poop plants over there, that's all famous and like all that. But when you fished in my neighborhood, you only caught catfish pretty much.
Yeah.
And that's in the 70s now.
So we have catfish that are native to the Chesapeake Bay. These are white catfish, bullhead catfish. They've been here. They're native.
Native, thousands of years.
Yeah, they've been here for as far back as we know. But what happened about 30, 40 years ago was Virginia imported blue catfish which are native to the Ohio and Mississippi River drainages. And they were brought in as a sport fish. These catfish get to enormous sizes. They can exceed 100 pounds.
They're like carp, right? Or like bigger
than
that.
But they, you know, people like to catch big fish. And they like to hold them and demonstrate them. And they like to show them off and like to eat them, I guess. So these fish were brought in as sport fish in the, and they implanted in, or stocked in the James River in the early 1970s. Seemed like a harmless exercise, right?
But who allowed it? I mean, how I mean, we had different regulations.
One of my sister agencies in Virginia, which at the time was the Virginia Department of Game and Inland Fish, had a few biologists. They got together and said, hey, let's stock these blue catfish. This sounds like a great idea. They get big, and I think we've got something.
What harm could
here.
We do? Yeah. Oh, look at this. She brought me shrimp salad. Look at this. Now, how am I going to get radio done with as much as I like to talk with this much food? I mean, you're just like every other restaurateur I know. When I order, I said, bring me a couple, like, three oysters. She brings me a dozen oysters, a crab cake, and a pound of shrimp salad here. So we're going to be picking at all this. This is a crab cake tour. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. But so keep going. You're talking catfish.
Right. So back in the 1970s, I was 10, 11, 12 years old. This decision gets made to bring these fish in. They think it's a great idea. We'll bring them in. The fishermen will catch them. They'll think it's wonderful. What they didn't realize is these are an amazing predatory fish. Basically, anything a blue catfish can fit into its mouth, it will eat. A large animal that's 70, 80, 90 pounds will eat ducks. They'll eat cormorants. They'll eat seabirds. They'll eat whatever they can fit in their mouth. They're incredible predators. And people think of catfish as a slow-moving, docile animal that trudges along the bottom and kind of roots
like
into the
carp.
Mud.
Yeah.
Not, this animal is not like that. This is a highly predatory fish, and it reproduces unbelievably. So what we have is, since the 70s, it gradually spread from the James River to the York to the Rappahannock, eventually into the Potomac River. And in 2018 and 2019, our worst nightmare was realized. We had this inundation of rainfall that started in April of 2018, and it persisted until July of 2019. What all that rainfall did was it knocked the salt content down in the water all throughout the Chesapeake Bay. Those catfish, which were kind of pushed up in the rivers like the Potomac and the James and the York and the Rappahannock, they all were like, oh, we can move around now. All the salt content's been knocked down, because they don't like a lot of salt in the water. They're freshwater fish from Ohio and Mississippi River drainages. So these fish all of a sudden said, there's no barrier. We're going to keep moving around. So in my river, the Potomac, where those fish normally were like from the Route 301 bridge up for the most part, our pound net fishermen down by Point Lookout, if you know where that is.
I do.
They never caught these catfish. They were calling me up saying, Marty, I just caught 3,000 pounds of blue catfish out of my pound net this morning. They had clearly moved down the river. They went out into the
chest. You saw this instantly
We saw it happening. And then they not only did they come down the rivers, they went out into the bay, and then they moved to every other river. So they went up into the Chester, the Choptank, the Patuxent, the Bohemia, everywhere, the Patapsico. They just went everywhere during that time frame. It was like opening Pandora's box. So now we have a situation where this highly predatory, non-native catfish is everywhere. And folks like me that study these things, along with our academic institutions like Chesapeake Biological Laboratories, Virginia Institute of Marine Sciences, all these folks are getting together, and we're trying to understand what the ecological implications of all this spread is, and we don't know. That's the horrible thing. There's so much uncertainty over how much ecological damage the species can inflict. It's really, really scary. Hence, Governor Moore putting in that disaster declaration to hopefully bring financial resources to help us better understand not only what the ecological damage is, how can we solve it. The one good thing, as you all know, is they're really good to eat, so that's the silver lining. And up to about 33, 34 inches, the meat on a blue catfish is as free of contaminants as any fish you can get. It's one of the best things you could eat. Once they get 35, 36, 30, you know, and bigger, they're a little older, they're starting to eat fish, they're bioaccumulating some contaminants. It doesn't mean you can't eat them, but a large, large catfish like that, you probably don't want to eat every single day or three times a week. You want to you know, you want to measure that. But the catfish that we're catching commercially now, which are now becoming a kind of really major part of the income for commercial fishermen, in the Potomac, in my jurisdiction alone, not including the tributaries that flow into the Potomac, our commercial fishermen caught over 3 million pounds of blue catfish last year. Almost all of them went to the Jessup markets where they were processed, and then they go out and they get disseminated. I guess, I don't know, maybe Fadley's get by some. So a lot of the processors in Jessup are cutting these fish coming out of the Potomac and elsewhere. So we're making lemonade out of lemons, I guess you would say.
You're never going to get rid of them, though, right?
You're never going to get rid of them.
I'm an optimist.
I'm an optimist, and I do not believe you can extirpate these fish. I think they're here to stay. But I will tell
you, snakeheads, can you get rid of them, or are they here forever?
I think they're here as well. But the thing about snakeheads, we were absolutely really concerned about their ecological impacts. It seems as though they've been around long enough that we've studied them, we've looked at their diet, and I'm not saying they're not having an impact. They certainly probably are, but they're not changing in a huge way the trophic dynamics. That's a fancy term we use for the food chain and the food web. They're not changing that in a dramatic fashion. So it seems to us, to me and my colleagues...
Most importantly, they're not eating the crabs at that level.
I don't think so, no. I have never heard snakeheads and crabs, you know, being kind of thing. They're eating fish primarily, and mostly minnows and small sunfish and things like that. So snakeheads, I'm not going to dismiss that they're having an impact. They're invasive. We should probably catch as many as we can. That's another fish, as we all know. It's delicious. Have you had it?
I have not.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know. Somehow we have to get him a snakehead.
People have told me they don't like it, and I've had other people tell me they do like it.
I need to talk to the person who told you they don't like it, because I have yet to hear one person say that.
It's a white mild fish.
It's a white mild fish.
It's incredible. Really is. It's amazing. And we actually issue a commercial bow hunting license, because that's the easiest way to catch them. You would think a net or a fishing rod, but folks go out at night with bows, and they use lights, halogen lights, and the fish, sort of like the term deer in the headlights, they just freeze, and they bow hunt them, and they fill coolers up with them, and they get an extraordinary price per pound. I think the bow hunters are getting like $5 a pound, which for a commercially harvested species, that's a tremendous.
I mean, talk a little bit about the people that do this for a living, because I just go over here and see rockfish and say, I'm pissed it's this much, or hey, look, it's on sale, or hey, you know, crab's a little bit down this year. Pricing is what people see when they're putting it on a grill or they're feeding themselves with it. But what I saw on the crab cake tour, especially getting out of bed early in the morning, and in places like La Plata and those places down on the water and near your bridge, this is a way of life for so many people in the state that go out. And to your point, $5 a pound is better than $4 a pound. And if you can catch the fish, catch the fish. And if you're feeding people, feed people. How many people do make a living doing this?
Yeah, I wish I knew the number.
I had Tony
exactly.
Conrad last summer talking about Conrad's. He takes his boats out and does all that stuff. He offered to take me out in the morning, and it kind of fell apart. My wife got sick. But I want to go do that, because seeing what a day's work looks like there, I've seen it on video. I've seen documentaries and all. It's a different... most people in the city don't have a concept of what that's about. You see it every day.
Yeah, so you asked the number. So it's a small number. So in the Potomac, we issue about roughly 1,000 commercial licenses. Some of those folks are on the water every day. Others are part-timers. In Maryland, I'm sure that's maybe in excess of 10,000, maybe 15,000, 20,000 commercial licenses. And again, there's some people, some commercial watermen that are on the water every single day. Others are on there part-time. But there's
if you crab, you do something else in the winter, right? Like literally.
Well, they oyster in the winter, and we have had good oyster seasons the last couple of years, and hopefully that's going to continue.
Why is that?
Well, I wish I had a good explanation for you, because that same rainfall event that I told you that occurred in 1819, that resulted in a lot of mortality in our oyster population in the Potomac and in Maryland. Not so much in Virginia, because it stays salty down there. Oysters thrive in higher salinities. When that rainfall event occurred, we lost a lot of oysters. So we really thought we were in for a long, painful recovery. And that's Mother Nature, and it's all of its uncertainty. We had two, maybe three consecutive years, I want to say the summer of 19, 20, and 21, where the salinity was up, the oysters reproduced, and everything came together magically, and we had this great, what they call a spat set, all throughout Maryland, Virginia,
and the Potomac. Does anything eat oysters? No, right? No.
Sure, yeah. I mean, when they're really little, they're vulnerable to a number of predators, primarily, like, there's different mollusks, these things called oyster drills that will go into them. Crabs love little tiny baby spat oysters. They love them, and they'll chew them up. But when they, you know, when they reproduce well, which they did in 19, 20, and 21, you know, there's plenty of food for the natural predators, and there's plenty of oysters, and they flourish. And so what we've seen the last couple of years are really, really a bump. The harvests have gone up in Maryland and in the Potomac. And Virginia's had really good harvest too. So things are going really well with oysters now. I would say we got a ways to go. We're still managing kind of in a cautionary way. We still use sanctuaries, which is, you know, a lot of people, it's a big political dynamic debate over how we manage to get more. Everybody wants more oysters in the bay, right? The scientific community, the watermen themselves, everybody, we put everybody in a room and it's a really fascinating conversation. It gets really colorful. but we try to do our best.
As I sit here and eat fried oysters, by the way, faintly. So
yeah, and we want to eat oysters.
Marty Gary's here. If you just join us on the radio, I got shrimp salad, crab cake. You're going to have to help me eat some of this. Marty Gary, he knows things about fish. He's a biologist, so fair enough. So keep going with this, because I'm fascinated by all this. Keep going.
So, but get back to your waterman thing. So traditionally, they were called watermen because they worked on the water year-round, and they would cycle through the seasons, and they would crab in the summer, and they'd fish in the summer and the fall, and then they would oyster it during the winter. And then there's all different niche fisheries that occurred. Soft-shell clams were once abundant in the bay. Back in the 90s, boy, we had them. And they're great. I love mannos. They're so awesome. But they kind of, so things wax and wane. And then we've got this gorilla in the room called climate change, which...
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I mean,
it's a changing bay. The bay is changing, and...
You mentioned salination, you mentioned air temperature, water temperature, predators, all of these variables that go into it. Well, nothing's more of a variable than, like, what the temperature is going to be. I mean, we all feel it. It's the middle of June. It was, you know, 68 degrees the other day. Mm-hmm. You know, it's crazy how unpredictable it must be from a science standpoint, where you're looking for control groups or you're looking at history. History's got nothing to do with the future, right? What would a couple of degrees one way or another mean for the bay?
Oh, it means a huge amount.
I say as a scientist, look at me. And we're all sitting here eating shrimp, listening to you.
Well, when you're eating shrimp, and you know what's really fascinating? The state of Virginia just started a white shrimp fishery at the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay.
They were
never there before. So
they're coming up.
Yeah, they're coming up the coast from the Carolinas, and they're fishing. And
I was going to ask you why we've never had shrimp here. Why? It's just not hot enough, right? The water's not warm enough.
They're a more temperate, warm water species, right. And it's getting milder. We're having these mild winters, and it's always going to be, I think, a little bit ephemeral. You're going to see some years better than others, but the long-term trend is a warmer bio.
100 years from now, there'll be shrimp in the Chesapeake Bay.
Maybe. I mean, who knows, but I think I wouldn't bet against it.
Whereas 20 years ago, you would have said, nah, not possible. Water's too cold.
And the takeaway really is, as they warm, even just a little bit, like a degree or two, there's going to be winners and losers. We're already seeing that. So, for instance, flounder, when I first started my career in the mid-1980s, I used to go out with a commercial waterman. And during the fall, over in the Hooper Islands, we go out, and you can guarantee they would be catching big flounders. They were beautiful. And I was like, wow,
Damey's yelling
off
air like a doormat. Like, literally.
Right. But now we have little ones that use the estuary as a nursery area, but you don't see the bigger ones. And what we're seeing in the broader high-altitude vision is these bigger flounders are moving north and east into cooler water. They just don't tolerate this warm water. The Chesapeake still functions as a nursery for the little flounders, but not the big ones. So they're a loser, an example of a loser.
So flounders are more Long Island-y, kind of, like, up that way?
Long Island's going to be a beneficiary. Jersey, they're moving north and they're moving east. So they're an example of a loser. A winter is blue crab. Blue crabs thrive in warmer weather. You have a longer growing season than we would have had 40, 50 years ago in the
Chesapeake Bay. So climate change is helping crabs in Maryland.
They're helpful to crabs. Crabs are a winner. Flounders are a loser. And some species are a mix.
I love Baltimore Positive on days like today.
God,
I'm learning
right,
stuff here.
Exactly.
You gotta get rid of the catfish.
You got to get on the mic if you're going to talk. You got to come around and get on the mic.
The X factor is these predators we've introduced.
We're fading these. What happens? Marty Gary comes on, and Damie's like, I'm opening a restaurant. I got some things to do. And the next thing you know, she's like, I'm having this conversation that you should have been on to begin with, because you're the one that began with the catfish with me a couple months ago to learn. You're learning too, aren't you?
Yes. Told him, I said, you cannot go on your crab cake tours without learning about what's happening with the catfish in the Chesapeake Bay. I said, you got to educate yourself.
But I
educate
didn't know
the
that
people.
They were different kind of catfish. They were a different kind of catfish.
Yes.
And we have another catfish called flathead catfish, which are also not native, and they don't get as much of attention because they're more up in the rivers. They like hard, rocky bottoms. But if you all were going to go up to the Susquehanna of Conowingo Dam and spend an hour just sitting on the bank, you'll watch a group of fishermen that go up there almost every day, and they catch these enormous flathead catfish that also get 60, 70, 80 pounds. And they're kind of stuck up in these.
That's a couple hundred dollar fish, right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I do think the Jessup processors handle a few of those, but not a lot. You probably know all of those folks down there in Jessup. Pat Welch, maybe, from Alliant. The J.J. McDonald people
right.
and all.
Right.
They tell me that they do handle some flatheads, but the yield off of those fish isn't as quite as good. So they're kind of like they'll take them, and they taste fine. But the blue catfish are really the one that's driving it. And they're the ones that are most abundant and can impact the most areas of the Chesapeake. And so those are the ones we're really concerned about. There was a study, just quickly relating to the crabs, the first one, we all suspected it was true, but a researcher named Mary Fabrizio, a professor down at Virginia Institute of Marine Science, just published last December the first true study on blue catfish predation on blue crabs. This was conducted in the James River, and it was astounding and eye-opening, the number of crabs.
They're
eating
the crabs.
Oh, yeah.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah.
And, well, which is another reason why they taste so good. You are what you eat.
So,
you know. But and a good reason to get them out of there and eat them. And our friends at Tillman Island, you know, that you went down to his processing plant, he has shifted completely to a catfish this year. He's not even picking any crabs because he's really adamant about getting that population down because they're struggling further up the bay with these catfish.
How far up are they going now?
Well, it's really they're in every river, and it's not so much they're going up. They're already up. They're up as far as they can go. Think of it the other way around. How far down the rivers can they go because of the salt content? It's a dry year this year. This year, it's so dry. I want to say it's matching up with some of the records that go back like 70, 80 years. What's happening is because it's so dry, we've had so little freshwater inflow into all the rivers that the salt content in the main bay is spread up. The salt wedge goes up the rivers. Catfish don't like it. They go upriver.
Right. They're pushing up.
But when we get rainfall, and we have had a little bit of rain like in the last week or so, that pushed the salinity down a little bit. As soon as they sense that, they start moving down. More room
to
go.
They don't like the salt.
They don't like the salt.
But those rivers are where we typically get our bigger crabs in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, as far as the crabbers are concerned, they're battling between the catfish and the crabs.
Right.
Because they're eating those bigger ones. You know, we got loads of little ones.
Should I tell
we don't
eat
have
more
very
catfish?
Many big
is that
ones.
What I, is that what should be a me- What's the message to people, Marty?
Yeah. I think catfish, I would personally love to see everybody eating catfish on a weekly basis. A couple times a week, every food cart, every restaurant should have
catfish.
Local catfish on the menu. I mean, I don't know, there's a marketing, they've made progress, right, in the last 10 years,
right.
But still...
We haven't figured that one out.
Yeah, it's...
I mean, we could call it something else, and we'd probably, you know, everybody would make a fortune on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because catfish, people have this connotation of being a muddy flavor because they are a bottom feeder. these do not taste muddy. Mm-hmm. These are getting up, and like he said, they're eating everything. They're even eating all the baby rock. I mean,
well, she's been telling me for 5 months we need to eat more catfish. She said this catfish thing's a problem. So I'm glad I got you out here on 4th of July weekend, or at least, you know, Wes Moore was in on this, to your point. But just what it means to the state and what it's going to mean to crabs, quite frankly, here.
Yep.
It's a win all around if we catch more of these catfish, if we eat more of these catfish. And the largest animals, which, again, what's happening here, they grow so fast. So a fish that's this big is only maybe 3 years old.
Right.
Right? And but they get...
Some of them half the size of this table.
Exactly.
They're this big. I know you're looking at me like, are you kidding
me?
They are. And we have all kinds of other things coming up into the bay this year. Mm-hmm. We have drum, tons of drum now. Mm-hmm. They're seeing, I'm hearing the fishermen say, we got all these drum that we haven't seen in years. The skate are up there eating everything. And so that all hurts this crab
skate
population.
Skate fish tastes good. I know that.
Yes.
I like that.
Yeah. I'm going to be the outlier on this one. We tried the skate, well, Cal Knows Ray.
Uh-huh.
We tried that, I guess, with the Virginia seafood marketing folks. I guess it was about 10 years ago, and they came in with three different kinds, and I couldn't get past it. I don't know.
No?
And you like fish.
I do. Yeah, that was the one I had struggled with, I think. But, yeah, so I think with the catfish, it's getting a lot of attention. I just wish we could get that on every restaurant's menu and get everybody on board with, you know, I mean, I stop in at least once a week to Wegmans. Whole Foods sells it. I mean, Giant's now carrying it.
I'm at Wise. I'm going to check Wise. Wise Market's my sponsor.
Get Wise. If they don't have them, get them on it.
Yeah.
They,
get
they
them.
Got catfish. I know and they do.
But they got to have Bay Chesapeake, not farm-raised catfish.
Yes, right. Not the farm-raised. So the farm-raised is completely different. That's the ones that they're, you know, farming down in the Delta. Those are cheap and easy to get for the grocery chains. We need them to be buying these blue catfish out of the Chesapeake. And that is, it's a little more expensive. We're just getting up, and we'll probably get cheaper as they start really developing.
We got to go from bay to table. We got to take farm to table, bay to table is what we need to do, right?
This is a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
You can't lose with it, I think.
You know, they can do so much with the fish. The Ivy Hotel here in Baltimore literally joined forces with... some purveyors and some processors, and made a documentary on the catfish. Did you see it?
I did not.
No, they've just their chef. They're really pushing it at a high line. You know, our best, you know, 5-star hotel here, pushing the catfish on their menus, which, you know, was really nice to see. And they've made this wonderful documentary about the catfish, its impact, and them going forward trying to market the catfish.
Right, I'm going to take this on one of my
fine
calls,
dining.
All right? I'm going to make it a call. I need a new clause this year. The Orioles are fixed. I got to fix something else. How about that?
You know, the paradox here is those farm-raised catfish in the South. I mean, I went to school in the South, and there was catfish restaurants all over the
right.
place. And people eat it every day, and they have catfish fries.
Right.
We're not there yet up
no,
here.
No, we're not there yet.
They do
we
it down
do
there.
We do crabs here, you know?
Well, and the catfish they're using at the fish fries in the restaurants are farm-raised in ponds, and they give the fish pharmaceuticals to
right.
control disease. These are wild-caught, no pharmaceuticals, no nothing. And again, MDE and in Virginia, Department of Environmental Quality, test the fish for contaminants. I'm telling you, these fish are as clean and as contaminant-free as anything you can catch in the Chesapeake Bay. There's nothing in them. There's no methyl mercury because they grow so fast. You're catching an animal that's very young that hasn't accumulated anything. So they're very good and healthy to eat. It's almost like a perfect, you know, again, I don't know, the whole lemonade out of lemons deal.
I would make it with a little lemon, maybe some caper.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah?
That sounds good to me. One of the things that my friend... Nick down at Tillman Island Seafood, when he was trying to really start a big processing, catfish processing, he had a difficult time because there's a law on the books, a federal law, that you have to have a USDA inspector when you gut a catfish. And understandably, this was meant for the Delta. It was meant for the farms so that they could, you know, control the quality of these pond-raised catfish. it's a completely different animal up here, but it stopped him from actually starting a processing plant 2 years ago because they wanted to, you know, sometimes somebody might have 1,000 pounds, somebody might have 300, somebody might have 250. You can't get an inspector to come in and watch you gut these fish in order to process them. And it stopped him for a while, and I believe they've worked that out.
Yeah, that is an incredible story. And the nuts and bolts of it are that we got swept up in the USDA inspection process through the Farm Bill in 2017. And it was, I'm sorry, Jamie, right?
Yes,
yeah.
Damie. Yes.
Okay. All right. First time we've met, and I'm going to see a lot more of you because I live in Catonsville, and I can't wait for the fishmonger's wife.
Damie Hunt's here,
and catfish will be on the menu.
We're talking about fish. So,
keep going. So to build on what Damie just said, so we got caught up in this rogue wave we never anticipated called the Farm Bill with a special shift of catfish, all catfish in the United States having to be required to be inspected by the USDA. Now, think about it. The average person doesn't know what that means. USDA inspects beef, poultry, pork, chicken, and because of salmonella and listeria and all these other pathogens, those facilities have to be pristine. And they're inspected. They have an inspector in there every day. The rigor of that inspection process is brutal. But in the seafood industry, they don't have that level of rigor. The FDA was doing it. We don't have the contaminant issues and that you have to be careful of with beef, pork, poultry. So FDA did seafood, including catfish, all fish, shrimp, oysters, everything. And USDA did meat. But because of this concern about Asian catfish flooding the market, undercutting the Delta produced Arkansas, Louisiana, Alabama produced all these farm-raised catfish in ponds, because of that, the senators got together and said, and it was supposed to be under the auspices of health, human health, but truly it was a political issue. All these Asian catfish were coming in and undercutting the market, so they put inspection requirements on them that were more rigorous. And the farm raised catfish in the South could adhere to it. What they didn't realize is it was going to affect the catfish up
here. Wild caught. So think of a farm. They could say, all right, all these catfish are at our 2 pound minimum. We're ready to cut them all, and you're gonna have an inspector in to cut 20,000 pounds. That's not the way we fish wild.
Right.
You know, some comes in on one boat, some comes in on another boat. You're not holding them. You're going to cut them immediately. And so it was a struggle to balance how do we adhere to this law and actually attack this blue catfish problem in the Chesapeake Bay as a wild caught, not a farm-raised
animal. Where are we now?
So where we are, we're still under USDA, but the cutters, the processors have adapted to that process. Here's my concern. So the harvesters sell to the processors. Processors have adjusted to USDA, but we have just a handful of processors that are controlling the chain of custody, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my concern is we don't have enough flexibility. We did get the gentleman from Tillman. I've never had the pleasure to meet him, but heard
He's
great
wonderful.
Things about him.
Wonderful.
So that's helpful, but he had to adapt to that USDA process too. Not everybody can build a facility that's state-of-the-art. Like if you,
right.
You should go down and do a show down in Jessup and see. I mean, these facilities are absolutely mind-blowing. But they
They're
can
beautiful.
Adhere to it. But I think our concern is, you know, we don't have the flexibility, you know, to have a small cutter, say, I don't know, up in the Upper Eastern Shore near Chestertown. They've got to go to Tillman, or they got to truck them all the way over to Jessup. So I think we still need, there is no real reason to have it under USDA. And we do have the Farm Bill coming up for another
approval. Cut out wild caught.
Exactly.
Just cut out the wild caught.
Yep.
Use the USDA on all farms and cut the wild caught out. If it's wild caught, it's not the same issue.
Yeah.
It's wild. It's not the same issue. If they could just redo the verbiage on that, we're done.
Yeah, and to that point, I went up on Capitol Hill to meet with, at that time, it was Richard Shelby from Alabama, the gentleman from Thad Cochran from the Mississippi, who has now passed away. Cochran and his staff were the gatekeepers because he was on the Budget Appropriations Committee in the Senate. And we got a meeting with all those folks up on Capitol Hill. This was late 16. And when we came up, we asked her exactly what Damie said, a carve-out to exclude our wild-caught catfish. Just exclude them and let them be inspected through the FDA process. They looked at us across the table and they said, why? And they said, because we have an impending ecological catastrophe on our hand. That was 2017, right? And they said, okay, where's your proof? Where's your data? Show me.
Oh, shoot.
We couldn't do it. We said...
You didn't have the papers done yet.
We did. Well, the thing of it was that disaster occurred during that first, we call it a freshet, all that freshwater inundation I was telling you all about in 2018, 2019. That's when the gates went open. That's when the fish went everywhere. Now we have an opportunity to go back and say, what we told you in 2017...
And they had been in the other area for 40 years, right? 50 years.
They had been... You mean the blue...
Not invasive, right.
You mean in the Chesapeake drainage?
Correct.
They had been introduced in the 70s, but they were stuck down in a couple places.
Right, they were stuck, right, okay.
Yeah, they were in the James Rappahannock. They were in the Potomac. They were starting to see them because people were moving these things around, and they still do. We just knew it was a matter of time. It wasn't if, it was when it was going to happen. That's what we tried to tell them. So when the 17 edition of the Farm Bill came up, we said, This is the part
in the disaster movie where nobody listens to the scientists.
He said, let's do the carve. Well, it wasn't just the scientists. I think we're all on that page,
yes.
Right? And we said, do the carve out. And I don't blame them. They were saying, okay, show us your proof. We couldn't. But when the freshet came and all the fish went everywhere, now they're everywhere, now we have proof. The Farm Bill, guess what? It's being reauthorized at the end of this year. So I'm hoping Jamie Raskin, I don't know if he's going to be a Congress. I mean, he's in the House now, right? He's going to potentially be running for Senate.
We're going to find out.
Yeah. So, I mean, people like that can help us with the Farm Bill. So we have another...
Well, this is a Cardin Van Hollen issue right now.
It is right now, yes.
Okay.
So we have an opportunity with the Farm Bill now, this next iteration, which I think is fall of 23, to do that carve-out Damien and I were talking about. And I think now we have the proof. We have everything right. We need. There should be no way to refute everything we've been saying. But it was very interesting to hear that conversation. It's highly political, but that I think gets us to a better place. If we get it back to FDA, then there's a lot more flexibility for the harvesters
right.
to go to smaller cutters. We don't have to be under the auspices of this very rigid, very rigorous USDA inspection process.
I'm glad you educated me about it, man.
And it's hard to do.
People have no idea what it takes to get their food to the table. It's really amazing.
And why it costs what it costs.
Yes. And that's why I have these signs up that says that it takes an entire bushel of crabs to make 1 pound of jumbo lump. Mm-hmm. You know, so, I don't get that many crab cakes out of a pound of crab meat. So, you know, this is what it's taking. Mm-hmm. Somebody's got to catch them. Somebody's got to, you know, process them, pick them. It's got to be brought up here, and I only get 1 pound out of a whole bushel of crabs.
And keep you safe, and have it be, you know, fresh and all of that.
Correct.
Marty Gary, Damie Hahn, I want to thank both of you for coming by the Maryland Crab Cake Tour today. That is a Maryland crab cake right here, because I'm at Faithley's. We're down here at Lexington Market, the old market since 1782. The Maryland Lottery bringing it to you. I've got a lottery ticket. Here, has a lottery ticket for you. Would you like one? There you go. Courtesy of Maryland Lottery. See that? Baltimore Positive's on a scene here giving out lottery tickets. Oh, you need one too? All right, here you go. A lottery ticket for you. One. I feel like Oprah when I'm here doing this. We're going to step out, take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about the new market. We are in the old market here. Damie's been talking about crab cakes here all afternoon. All of it brought to you by our friends at Winder Nation, 866-90-NATION. You can buy two, you get two free. 0% financing for the next 2 years. We're going to be kicking off the 25th anniversary in Dundalk, my homeland, on August the 3rd. We'll be at Costas on the 3rd. We're going to be at Drug City on the 4th. I'm going to have my crab mallet from Raskin Global with the beer opener, because how else am I going to get the beer opener to celebrate? Marty, thank you very much. Appreciate you. My love to Catonsville, and you're coming to Catonsville. And So you want
to
ask when you're opening? Go ahead.
Do we have a date?
Next summer sometime. No. But we're permits are in, so you know we're waiting to hear from the county.
That's awesome. Well, so it's going to be a great addition, and we're looking forward to it. So we are too.
Ever ask a restaurateur to bring you a little bit of shrimp salad and a little bit of fried oyster, because you'll wind up getting like all of this. This is the oyster here that inspired the 25th anniversary oyster tour.
Yes,
because
you've got
to
do an oyster
tour. Some have you had a fried oyster here?
No.
Do you eat fried oysters?
I do.
Yeah. Hey, please, have one. They're delicious.
You have to taste them.
Yeah, absolutely, man. You got to get after one of
these. These are the wild-caught Chesapeake Bay primes. These are delicious. Mm. So they are yummy.
Mm. in my mouth, in my belly.
That's awesome.
Aren't they delicious? I don't think people realize how good they are. They are so good.
You make them the right way. All right, my mouth's full. Back for more Baltimore Positive right after this.